Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You pays your money, you takes your chances. That's the saying, anyway. Wall Street spent years taking chances with our money. Now the Fed wants to change the way they are paid. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, everybody. This one is the 18th of September, and it is great to have you with us. Congress is talking about new regulations for the financial industry. The White House is talking about new regulations for the financial industry. Largely unencumbered by politics as it is, the Federal Reserve might actually be the first to do something about new regulations for the financial industry. The Wall Street Journal reported today that the Fed is drafting a plan to clamp down on Wall Street bonuses. Damian Paletta had the story in the paper this morning. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
What, as you understand it, is the Fed's plan here?
So the Fed is going to propose some guidelines that are going to be pretty sweeping, and it's going to affect more than 5,000 banks in the country, but they're really going to focus on the 25 biggest banks. What they're going to do is they're going to look closely at the compensation packages banks pay their employees, not necessarily on the level of money that employees are paid, but what they're going to look at is the incentives that banks give their employees to take risk. So, for example, if a bank pays their loan officers a lot of money just to originate loans, but not necessarily on whether those loans perform, then that's the kind of thing that the regulator is going to be taking a tougher look at now.
We all understand that over the past year, year and a half, the Fed has become a more powerful place. But can they just do this? Can they plop regulators down inside these banks and start setting forth policy?
The Fed thinks they have this authority as the safety and soundness regulator of these banks. Their interest is to keep these banks safe and sound and from failing. And what a lot of people have said happened over the last year is that these compensation packages incentivized extremely risky behavior that threatened the safety and soundness of banks. So this is something that folks have been taking a much closer look at. Congress is also looking at doing something in this area, but the Fed thinks they can go ahead and act unilaterally here.
That aspect of it, though, the Fed going it alone, has gotten some criticism from Democrats and Republicans up on the Hill. What's your take on what Congress is going to say about this?
Well, it's really interesting. We've already heard from a couple Republicans today that have slammed this move by the Fed and labeled it extremely political. The Democrats have really been pushing the Fed to be much more aggressive with the banks that are overseen. But Republicans have been very critical. I mean, there's a broader question, of course, about the future role of the Fed. There's a lot of skepticism about whether or not there should be a lot of power centralized within the Federal Reserve. They don't really answer to Congress. They don't have elected officials. But this is a question that's going to play out over the next several months as Congress looks at future regulation of financial markets.
Compensation on Wall Street used to be, you know, reasonably conventional. You got paid according to what you did and according to your seniority and salary structure. And then we saw these bonuses come up. Any belief that this might put the genie back in the bottle and we might get back to structured compensation on Wall Street?
It's a great question. I think it'll take some time to see how this works. If the Fed puts these principles out and the banks follow them pretty closely, then maybe we will get to a more sort of conventional conservative type of pay structure. Like you said, though, the banks might get creative and try to find ways around this. And also, you know, we're going to be dealing with complicated issues of U.S. banks competing with their foreign counterparts. And are the rules the same here as they are overseas? Those are all really difficult questions that it's going to take time to settle.
Are we missing the point by concentrating so heavily on bonuses and pay as a focus of regulation while not maybe reining in some of the actual behavior about ratings agencies and slicing and dicing these mortgage-backed securities? I mean, are we missing the point?
I think what the regulators are trying to do is put together a package of issues that need to change, they feel, on Wall Street in order for this financial system globally to perform in a safe and sound way. So there's going to be a lot of reviews of rating agencies and of banks and their lending practices and how much capital they hold in reserves, for sure. I think this issue, quite frankly, is so much easier for people to understand, you know, how much executives get paid and why they're paid, that it's easier for the Fed to move this issue forward now.
Damian Paletta, he's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, had a piece in the paper today on the Federal Reserve and corporate pay on Wall Street. Damian, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
To continue with a theme here, that is fixing what was and is broken on Wall Street, the credit rating agencies are back in the news. Yesterday, California Attorney General Jerry Brown subpoenaed the big three raters. That would be Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. He wants to see if they broke state laws with their AAA ratings of B-grade mortgage-backed securities. Meanwhile, the Securities and Exchange Commission has passed a bunch of new rules itself. The SEC wants more control over how the credit rating agencies rate. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
One new rule will force the credit rating agencies to show how their ratings for a company or a deal have changed over time. Sylvan Raines is a principal with R&R Consulting, which values structured security deals. He says if the agencies don't change their ratings often, it'll be a sign something funny is happening.
If you see the ratings are not moving at all, and yet you, by looking at these data, you can see out there trouble, you can know that the rating agencies are not doing their job.
Ratings agencies already sell this data to subscribers. The SEC's plan would make them give it away for free. Another rule will make companies that use rating agencies share all their information with everybody. Jerome Fonts is a consultant on credit rating issues, and he says under the new plan, any agency will be able to offer a rating, whether they've been hired by a company or not.
So no matter what the final rating was by agency X, agency Y could come out and say, well, you know, based on our analysis, it's really, you know, this really isn't a AAA.
Fon says the SEC also wants the rating agencies to disclose how they get to their ratings. That's something they don't usually do.
Then it also makes it easier for investors and others to see whether or not the ratings themselves have been corrupted, because you'll be able to see, oh, do they adhere to the methodology or do they not?
SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro says the new rules are designed to expose conflicts of interest and protect investors who rely on ratings to buy securities. But Fonz argues not enough has changed, and the ratings agencies still have too much power. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
You know how every time a news report mentions Google, it's usually accompanied by the phrase search engine giant? That's close, but not entirely accurate. Yes, Google does search, but somewhere north of 95% of the money that company makes comes from search advertising. And today's news might only make Google more money. It's launching an online marketplace for display ads, those big colorful ones that float across your computer screen and distract you when you're trying to do something else moderately productive. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Google's new DoubleClick ad exchange is a marketplace where advertisers can bid for space on different web pages. Bert Flickinger is a consultant with Strategic Resource Group and helps companies decide how to spend their ad dollars.
Google getting into the display ad business is one of the biggest things that has happened in the advertising business in decades.
Flickinger said with search ads, you need to pay enough to be at the top of the list. But display ads can put advertisers right in front of a targeted group of customers.
Based on hitting a core consumer constituency, the display ads can be much more cost effective.
Google will be competing with Yahoo, which dominates the display ad marketplace. Display ads bring in about half of what search ads do, says Andrew Frank, an advertising analyst for Gartner Research. He says that's because they tend to be overly general and irritating.
A lot of display ads use annoying techniques like pop-ups and things like that.
Frank says Google hopes to merge display ads with search technology, and the combination could create a real cash machine.
Well, I suppose if Google is really successful, then they could, you know, vastly increase the relevance of the display advertising we see, which could make it less annoying and generally a better experience.
So the next time you saw an ad floating across the screen, it would be for something that you actually liked.
Right.
Frank says the move could also attract higher-end clients to Google, big brands like GE or McDonald's, who don't want to bother with search, but might be interested in something like a dancing hamburger. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you don't need Google to tell you we had numbers we haven't seen in a year. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All those predictions you've been hearing about how the unemployment rate is going to top 10% eventually, they are a bit more solid now. The Labor Department said today 42 states lost jobs last month. That's up from 29 just in July. It translates into a lot more people starting over, looking for new jobs or completely changing careers. Commentator Peter Bash had to do just that recently.
For 36 years, I had steady work, flying around the country doing presentations for investment banks. It was cozy and seemed so secure. Until it ended last year. Now I'm looking for what else I can do. This is a scary time, especially since my family has a grim tradition of starting over in your 50s with mixed results. My grandfather, Felix, was a Jewish filmmaker in Germany. He directed and acted in over 70 movies. When Hitler rose to power, Felix took his family to the United States. But Hollywood was full of German émigrés who knew how to wear a monocle. So Felix did smaller and smaller parts until 1944. That year he died. He was only 56 years old. 5 years after that, my father began a successful career as a glamour photographer. For the next 25 years, he took hundreds of thousands of pictures of every actress, starlet, dancer, and model. His pictures paid for my private school and my mom's fur coats. But in 1972, when he was 51, that industry changed. Dad did a pictorial for Playboy, the Girls of Scandinavia. When he came back with hundreds of beautiful pictures, the new photo editor turned them down, saying they weren't raunchy enough. My father, shocked and angry, locked up his cameras, and he never took another picture except for family snapshots. He had to keep working, so he started a one-man literary agency. He only had a few clients, but he could support himself and my mom. I was out of college, and mom could wear fake fur. Now I'm 53, and it's my turn. I don't want to be like poor Felix, so talented but so stubborn. I'd rather learn from my father, be creative, and adjust to a changing market. I've been playing with computers since the 80s, optimizing, fixing. My wife, Ellen, finally told me, you know, my friends are all envious that I have a resident nerd. Maybe some of them will hire you. Well, one just did. Bash Tech has its first customer, and more are on the way, so I'm trying to be flexible, imaginative, and patient. Grandpa, Dad, and Ellen, thanks for the lessons.
Peter Bash is a computer consultant here in Los Angeles. To hear more stories like Peter's and to add your own, go to our website, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Starting Over. The big story this week was, actually it was last year. As you've been reminded here and elsewhere, the scariest part of the financial crisis happened a year ago this past Tuesday with the passing of Lehman Brothers. That seems as good a place as any to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. And to do that, we've got Felix Salmon from Reuters here, also business writer Heidi Moore. Hello again.
Hello, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
We're going to pick up on this theme of last year at this time that we've been playing this week, Heidi, and I really only have one question, and it's actually a little bit serious. Are we safer now? Are we better off now having had Lehman Brothers go under?
If you actually take a look at the banking system, I think overall it probably is a lot less leveraged. You have perhaps fewer problems, and the problems that are there, everyone is highly aware of, which previously wasn't the case. So, you know, the banks aren't really getting away with anything, which I don't think you could have said prior to, you know, September 2008.
Felix, are we more sensitized?
I have to disagree entirely with everything that Heidi just said.
Lovely.
I think that Lehman's collapse was disastrous. It caused massive chaos in the markets, which we haven't come close to recovering from. If you look at the unemployment rate and the general depressed state of the economy, I think a lot of that can be traced back to the decision to allow Lehman to fail. And I think that the main hope in the wake of Lehman, which was that we would have big regulatory reform, has pretty much died, and that people aren't really expecting that anymore.
Yeah, so you're playing right into my crisis wasted theory here, which is that we've just missed the bubble. And Heidi, let me bring it back to you and ask you this. If Lehman Brothers had been saved, was there not a risk that something worse would have happened, that maybe Goldman would have gone under or somebody bigger and more interconnected?
If Lehman had not fallen, perhaps somebody else would have, and perhaps several of them would have. But at the same time, the fact that Lehman happened actually was a huge wake-up call. And if Lehman had not died, we wouldn't have TARP in its current form. We wouldn't have had the recapitalized banks. I mean, it's true. 8 months later, we don't have regulations. But when do regulations ever pass in 8 months? I mean, we really do have to be a bit more patient about reforming a system that had 70 years to go haywire.
Let me turn to the TARP, which Heidi just mentioned, the $700 billion bank bailout that Henry Paulson first went to the Hill to ask for a year ago this week.
And the Hill said no.
The Hill said no.
That was
time, right?
Actually the beginning of the crisis.
Right.
If you look at what happened to the bond market and the stock market, they actually coped, interestingly enough, with Lehman's collapse. But the thing which really sent everyone into a tailspin was when the House said no to TARP the first time around.
Right, and that was the day of the 777-point decline on the Dow. But here we are a year later. Some banks have extracted themselves, and now this week Citigroup tried to. Heidi, is it a good idea for Citigroup specifically to be allowed to get out from under?
Well, I think it would be an absolute mistake for Citigroup to try to seek its freedom now, basically only emboldened by the fact that its stock price has somehow mercifully gone up, which no one can explain. So if every bank goes to the government and say, hey, our stock price is up, that's exactly the same kind of short-term market-focused thinking that kind of got us into this mess. We have to take a look at the long-term fundamentals of each bank's ability to survive. And on that, Citigroup, I think it's fair to say, just doesn't cut it. You know, Vikram Pandit was speaking last night, and he said something funny. He said, you know, about commercial real estate, we've stepped in every pothole, but we didn't step in that one. I mean, think of a bank of that size stepping into every pothole of this crisis, and you think, all right, until they get it together, we really do need a lot of oversight.
All right, so let me bring this look back at a year ago this week to a close, and I'll go to the president, who was on Wall Street on Monday, made a big speech about new regulations and how the United States government is a reluctant shareholder. Felix, the question to you is, how long is it going to take to unwind all this stuff? The TARP, the Federal Reserve, the auto companies, all of that stuff.
5 to 10 years?
No,
seriously? It's going to take a long time, seriously.
Wow. I was not expecting that number.
Heidi, you any more optimistic?
I was going to say longer.
Oh, God.
I had my bet on. I mean, there was an official who just said that we're probably going to be stuck in some of those programs until 2019 at the least. So that's the starting point.
And we will call you up when that happens. Heidi Moore and Felix Salmon, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, the drama is over for one soap opera.
We ran the numbers every which way, upside down, backwards, sideways. We knew we had certain budget constraints we had to hit that could not be met shooting in the old style.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street went out on a high note today. The Dow Industrials rose 36 points, 0.75%, closed at 9,820. NASDAQ gained 6 points, nearly 0.3%, settled at 2,132. The S&P 500 rebounded 0.25%, wrapped up at 1,068. For the week that was, the Dow was up 2.2%. The NASDAQ gained 2.5%. The S&P 500 up 2.4%. Some analyst upgrades gave the markets a lift. Procter & Gamble jumped 3% after Citigroup lifted its price estimates. SanDisk, maker of flash memory cards, pumped up 5% today on a recommendation from Bank of America. And an upgrade for E-Trade Financial boosted the online brokerage 8.25% today. Bond prices fell. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.47%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis, the new book by Bill George from Josie Bass Publishers. Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis is available in bookstores everywhere. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. President Obama discusses the economy at a community college in Troy, New York. Later, he'll talk with David Letterman on The Late Show. Also in New York, a monthly look at where the economy might be headed. The Conference Board releases its Index of Leading Economic Indicators for August. And the United Nations marks International Day of Peace. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
You know, sometimes in life, things just aren't what they seem. Another way of putting that, a way that might fit better into the current retail climate, is that you can fool some of the people some of the time with a nice picture in the window. The story here is that cities across the country are decorating vacant storefronts with posters, murals, mosaics, anything to fill the holes left by this recession. The latest is upscale Palm Springs, California, where they're going to use city money to put work by local artists as well as old Hollywood photos into closed-up shops. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Call them commercially challenged, main streets and suburban ring roads and entire levels at the mall smattered with closed and for lease signs. It's a big bummer for shoppers, says retail analyst Patricia Edwards.
If there is a string of empty stores or even one or two in a line of five or six, that area is generally less trafficked, not just because there's less stores, but I believe because it's less interesting to be there.
Which is why cities around the country, from San Francisco to Philadelphia to New York, are trying out a kind of art therapy for suffering retail districts. Palm Springs will require empty properties to spruce up, says city manager David Reddy.
We're able to get donated art from local artists, or it could be historical photos of Palm Springs' rich history that the city has, but it can't just be a vacant storefront.
Patricia Edwards says she's all for letting local artists show their work. It might get people to go buy some art as they stroll by, but she says nix the pics of Crosby and Sinatra. That won't get people to spend money. What will? I asked Anishka Drajal. She's an expert in feng shui, the Chinese art of space and energy and all that stuff.
Well, you definitely want to go for things that are going to attract people's attention. So colors like red, colors that are green, like color of money. You could even put potted plants out, something that has a chi that's alive.
Some feng shui advice for cities suffering the retail blues. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This radio program has been on the air since 1989, 20 years, a pretty good run by most standards. But Marketplace can't hold a candle to Guiding Light. Today, CBS aired that soap opera's final episode, and a 72-year run, first on radio and then on TV, came to an end. Nate DeMayo looks back at how it started and why it faded to black.
Put new duds in your washing machine. Finest duds.
If you've ever spent your afternoon waiting to find out whether a doctor is actually a doctor or is in fact that doctor's evil twin, you pretty much have one woman to thank.
The Guiding Light, created by Erna Phillips.
In the early days of the Depression, Erna Phillips left her job as a Chicago school teacher for a career in radio, at a time when the new industry was just sorting itself out. Ron Simon is a curator at the Paley Center for Media.
I don't think radio knew there was going to be an audience in the afternoon. It was Erna Phillips that envisioned a new format.
We all know the format now, the serialized domestic melodrama, the soap opera. Phillips not only pioneered the opera part, which had huge audiences of women weeping into their washtubs, she invented the soap part, too.
Erna was very savvy about the marketing possibilities. If there was a wedding going on, she tried to find some type of company that would help sponsor that wedding and then be mentioned. She understood what product placement was all about.
And with her hit program Guiding Light, Phillips entered one of the longest and most successful marriages between mass entertainment and mass consumption in history. A partnership with Procter & Gamble that took Phillips' format to TV.
The Guiding Light. This portion is presented by Cascade with sheeting action. And by Zest, the deodorant bar that leaves you feeling cleaner.
Since the late 1930s, Guiding Light has been produced by P&G. Now, that's not sponsored by, but produced. It's a relic from the earliest days of radio and TV. Networks would lease airtime to corporations, and they'd be in charge of making shows good enough to land an audience. But that audience has become harder and harder for soaps to capture.
Well, if you look around the office, there's not much left.
Ellen Wheeler is the executive producer of Guiding Light. Well, she used to be anyway.
There's a phone, and we answer the phone to the fans when they call and say, please don't let the show go off the air.
She also used to be a soap star in the 80s on Another World, another Procter & Gamble show. And the 80s were a great time to be in soaps. There were more than a dozen on the air, but it also may have been the beginning of the end for the genre.
If you actually go back and check the ratings, you know, what we think of as being the height was already the beginning of a very, very slow decline.
That's because fewer and fewer women were staying home in the middle of the day. Then throw in DVRs and mobile devices and a gajillion cable channels, all chipping away at the ratings. And CBS, the network that had carried Guiding Light since the Truman administration, kept asking the show to tighten its belt. Two seasons ago, Ellen Wheeler and her bosses at P&G realized the belt was about to snap.
We ran the numbers every which way, upside down, backwards, sideways. We knew we had certain budget constraints we had to hit that could not be met shooting in the old style.
So they tried shooting in an entirely different way, one that was more shaky, handheld documentary than classic soap. Cheaper cameras, smaller crews, fewer actors, fewer sets, but the same delightfully preposterous plot twists.
Alan, no. It doesn't have to be this way. Put the gun down, leave Jonathan alone, and give us back Sarah. You're only doing this because you want Sarah, but you don't need her anymore because that's your baby.
My baby.
Not everyone was happy with the new Guiding Light. One critic even accused Wheeler of trying to make the show so bad, CBS would have to cancel it. She says nothing could be further from the truth.
We gave the audience 2 more years of Guiding Light, making these changes. We also brought something new and fresh to the whole idea of soap operas.
And she says there's going to have to be a whole new way of making soap operas, if there are going to be any soap operas at all. The money just isn't there. At one point, Procter & Gamble had 13 soap operas on the air. As of today, there's just one, The Young and the Restless, which is looking a little bit old these days. I'm Nate DeMeo for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields without increasing demands on natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, something to think about if you find yourself waiting on a slow internet connection this weekend. The chairman of the FCC will say on Monday that he is here to help. Julius Genachowski is going to reopen the wonky but increasingly important topic of net neutrality, the idea that internet service providers shouldn't be allowed to slow down some content and let other content go through. Those providers like Verizon and AT&T, they claim they ought to be able to charge for, say, video that takes more bandwidth. Google and Yahoo and the rest of them say that is not entirely fair. Told you it was wonky, but we'll be talking about it on Monday anyway. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 36 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ added 6 points, nearly 0.33%. The S&P 500 bounced up 2 points, 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ewell. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, if you need a financial role model, try the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Howlin' Wolf's a fantastic blues and early rock and roll singer, and he didn't trust banks.
He was ahead of his time then.
That's right. That's right.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.